Picture this. You are a prostitute living in the slums of Victorian England. Late at night, or early in the morning, depending on who you ask, you're walking home. You notice a shadowy figure start to follow you, but you think nothing of it. Big mistake. As you turn a corner, the figure attacks you. He kills you where you stand, and your body is mutilated with medical-grade precision, and you are left to rot. This may be hard for you to imagine, but for the five victims of Jack the Ripper, it was a reality. Picture this. You are a prostitute living in the slums of Victorian England. Late at night, or early in the morning, depending on who you ask, you're walking home. You notice a shadowy figure start to follow you, but you think nothing of it. Big mistake. As you turn a corner, the figure attacks you. He kills you where you stand, and your body is mutilated with medical-grade precision, and you are left to rot. This may be hard for you to imagine, but for the five victims of Jack the Ripper, it was a reality. Jack the Ripper is the nickname given to the perpetrator of a string of grisly murders that happened in London in 1888. To this day, his nickname is all that is known of him, as these Victorian murders remain unsolved. Our story begins on the 31st of August in 1888, when our first victim, a 43-year-old woman by the name of Marianne Nichols, was last seen alive. Reportedly, she had met up with her friend Emily Holland at around 2:30 in the morning and shared drinks with her. Just an hour and 20 minutes later, Nichols' severed body was discovered by Charles Cross. First victim, Mary Ann Nichols, was born in London on August 26 of 1845. She was born the second child of a blacksmith and a laundress. Little is known about her early life, but at the age of 18, she married a man named William Nichols. They soon divorced due to Mary Ann's heavy drinking and prostitution, which Williams did not support. After their separation, Mary lived in poverty and took any work she could get her hands on, though she struggled to keep a job. Her body was discovered by a man who worked as a carter named Charles Cross at 3:40 a.m. as he was walking to work. Cross did not realize what she was at first and called over another man who was walking to work as well to help him inspect. Getting a better look, he saw that it was the body of a woman. And they both noticed that her skirt had been pulled up, exposing her lower body. Upon further examination, Cross announced that he believed she was dead. The other man, a fellow carter by the name of Robert Paul, remarked, quote, "Think she's breathing, but very little if she is," end quote. Her body was discovered by a man who worked as a carter named Charles Cross at 3:40 a.m. as he was walking to work. Cross did not realize what she was at first and called over another man who was walking to work as well to help him inspect. Getting a better look, he saw that it was the body of a woman. And they both noticed that her skirt had been pulled up, exposing her lower body. Upon further examination, Cross announced that he believed she was dead. The other man, a fellow carter by the name of Robert Paul, remarked, quote, "Think she's breathing, but very little if she is," end quote. Thoroughly disturbed with the situation, the two men decided to leave the scene after pulling her skirt down to cover her lower body. They both agreed that they would notify the first police officer they saw after the incident, but they would not seek a police officer out. They were simply too rattled. What these two carters failed to realize was that this was not the body of a woman who had died an ordinary death, as her head was nearly cut off, her throat was slashed so severely. Thank you. Cross and Paul never ended up needing to notify an officer, as a constable by the name of John Neal discovered the body for himself. Constable John Neal arrived at Buck's Row, where her body lay, shortly after the two Carters had left. The street was dark and empty, as he knelt down to look at her body closer in the light of his lamp. "About her body," he said, "I examined the body by aid of my lamp, and noticed blood oozing from a wound in her throat. She was lying on her back, with her clothes disarranged. I felt her arm, which was quite warm from the joints upward. Her eyes were wide open, her bonnet was off, and lying at her side." End quote. With the help of two other constables, one of whom was alerted by Cross and Paul, Neal surveyed the scene. One of the constables, a man named John Thane, went to fetch reinforcements. He returned shortly with a police ambulance, more constables, and a Welsh doctor named Dr. Llewellyn. Dr. Llewellyn examined the body at 4 o'clock a.m., and at that time pronounced her dead. As he examined her body further, he noticed that her arms and legs were still warm, but her hands were cold. This led him to believe that she could not have been dead for more than a half an hour, and even suggested that the killer had just made his escape before Cross found the body 20 minutes prior. As word spread about town about the grisly killings, her body was able to be identified as Mary Ann Nichols. Our grim story takes us next to the murder of Jack's next victim, 47-year-old Annie Chapman. Like Mary Ann Nichols, Annie lived trapped in poverty, with her only source of income being selling fake flowers and prostitution. In early September of 1888, Annie found herself in an altercation with a woman who lodged in the same lodging house as her. Though no solid reports exist of what exactly caused the fight, it is known that the woman she scrapped with was a fellow lodger named Eliza Cooper. Her disagreement with Cooper lasted several days and ended in a bar fight. The fight went down in Britannia Pub on Dorset Street, the same street the lodging house she lived in was on. Annie reportedly slapped Eliza Cooper across the face, who retaliated by punching her in the eye and then again in the chest, leaving Annie badly bruised. It is not known whether this altercation would play a role in her murder-to-be. Chapman was last seen in the early morning of September 8th, walking down Hanbury Street in Spitalfields, East London. She was talking to a man who was never identified. A passerby, a woman named Elizabeth Long, overheard a brief exchange between the two. She heard the man say, "Will you?" and Annie reply, "Yes." That would be the last word she would ever be heard speaking, as her mutilated body was discovered not 30 minutes later at 6 o'clock a.m. Her slain body was discovered just outside the back door of an elderly man named John Davis's home. Terrified, Davis ran looking for help and ran into two workmen. The two men, named James Kent and Henry Holland, followed the old man to his back door where they saw her body. Overcome with shock, James Kent fled the scene to a bar. The more helpful of the two ran to get help from a police officer but was met with resistance from a constable stationed in Spitalfields Market who refused to follow him to the scene. Moments later, arriving at the scene along with reinforcements was Dr. Phillips, a police surgeon. The crowd had not dispersed as Inspector Chandler had ordered, and Dr. Phillips had to fight his way through a crowd of more than 100. When he finally came upon her body, he immediately observed that there was no possibility she could still be alive. Later, when asked to testify, he recounted of her body that the left arm was placed across the left breast, the legs were drawn up, the feet resting on the ground, and the knees turned outward. The face was swollen and turned on the right side. The tongue protruded between the front teeth, but not beyond the lips. tongue was evidently much swollen. The front teeth were perfect as far as the first molar, top and bottom, and very fine teeth they were. The body was terribly mutilated. The stiffness of the limbs was not marked, but was evidently commencing. The throat was dissevered deeply, that the incisions through the skin were jagged and reached right round the neck. On the wooden paling between the yard in question and the next, smears of blood corresponding to where the head of the deceased lay were to be seen. These were about 14 inches from the ground and immediately above the part where the blood from the neck lay. The next group of victims came in a pair. 44-year-old Elizabeth Stride and 46-year-old Catherine Eddowes were discovered mutilated on the same day, September 30th of 1888. On the night of Swedish-born Elizabeth Stride's death, she was reported to have been seen with several different men. On the night of her death at around 11 p.m., Stride was seen talking to and kissing a man who was described to be 5'5" with a dark mustache. 45 minutes later, she reportedly was seen kissing a different man who did not match the description of the first. This man was described to be at least 5'6" and clean-shaven. At 12:30 a.m., she was reportedly seen with another man, approximately 28 years old, with a dark mustache and 5'7" tall. Now, it is speculated that the first man and the third man were actually the same man, and the height was just a mistake. 15 minutes after she was seen with the third man, a man by the name of Israel Schwartz spotted a man and a woman together. The man was described as being 5'5", with broad shoulders and a small brown mustache. Schwartz watched the man attack the woman, so he crossed the street to avoid getting involved in a fight. Allegedly, as Schwartz tried to leave, the man looked up from the woman and called out the word Lipsky, which seemed to trigger another man who was standing nearby to begin pursuing Schwartz as he tried to leave. At 1 a.m., Stride's body was discovered by a man named Louis Dimeschutz. Dimeschutz was alerted of the presence of her body when the horse pulling his cart suddenly stopped in the middle of the street. He stopped to investigate and noticed that there was a woman lying there, and upon further investigation, he noticed that her throat was slit. Just as Stride's body was being discovered, our next victim, Catherine Eddowes, was being released from prison. Similar to our second victim, Annie Chapman, Catherine Eddowes was caught up in the crime that surrounded her in East London. Her final night alive was spent in prison. On the 29th of September, the day before her death, Eddowes was arrested for drunkenly disturbing the peace. At 12:55 a.m., 5 minutes before Elizabeth Stride would be discovered, Eddowes was released from police custody. She was last seen by a group of men at around 1:35 a.m., talking to a man who was described to be around 5'9" with a small mustache. Catherine's body was discovered just 15 minutes later, only a few feet away from where the man last saw her. Catherine Eddowes' slain body was discovered by Constable Watkins just 45 minutes after the discovery of Elizabeth Stride. He found her body in a similar state to our first victim's, with her skirt pulled up to expose her lower body and her throat slit. Immediately, he ran to get the aid of some night watchmen he knew were nearby, saying, quote, "Come to my assistance. Here is another woman cut to pieces," end quote. Fifteen minutes later, London police surgeon Dr. Frederick Gordon Brown arrived at the scene to inspect her body. The following is his description of her corpse. The body was on its back, the head turned to left shoulder, the arms by the side of the body as if they had fallen there, both palms upwards, the fingers slightly bent. A thimble was lying off the finger on the right side. The clothes drawn up above the abdomen. The thighs were naked. Left leg extended in a line with the body. The abdomen was exposed, right leg bent at the thigh and knee. The bonnet was at the back of the head. Great disfigurement of the face. The throat cut. Across below the throat was a neckerchief. The intestines were drawn out to a large extent and placed over the right shoulder. They were smeared over with some feculent matter. A piece of about 2 feet was quite detached from the body and placed between the body and the left arm, apparently by design. The lobe and auricle of the right ear were cut obliquely through. There was a quantity of clotted blood on the pavement on the left side of the neck, round the shoulder, and the upper part of the arm. And fluid blood-colored serum which had flown under the neck to the right shoulder, the pavement sloping in that direction. Body was quite warm. No death stiffening had taken place. She must have been dead most likely with the half hour. We looked for superficial bruises and saw none. No blood on the skin of the abdomen or secretion of any kind on the thighs. No spurting of blood on the bricks or pavement around. No marks of blood below the middle of the body. Several buttons were found in the clotted blood after the body was removed. There was no blood on front of the clothes. There were no traces of recent connection. Catherine Eddowes' gory demise would mark the second-to-last victim of Jack the Ripper. His fifth and final victim would be discovered over a month later, on November 8, 1888. Mary Kelly, our final victim, was the youngest of the five at only 25 years old. Like the other victims, Mary was a prostitute and made her meager pay that way. On the night of her death, she was last seen with an unidentified man on Dorset Street at 2 o'clock a.m. 2 hours later, at 4 a.m., several locals reported hearing a cry of murder in the area where she was last seen. At 10:45 a.m. the following morning, Mary Kelly's rent was overdue. Her landlord, John McCarthy, sent his assistant to go collect the money. The assistant, a man by the name of Thomas Boyer, went to her house and knocked on the door. When there was no answer, he looked through the window and was met with a horrific sight. He returned to McCarthy and told him, quote, "I knocked the door and could not make anyone answer. I looked through the window and saw a lot of blood," end quote. Horrified, McCarthy followed his assistant to her room to look for himself. What he saw was unimaginable. A traumatized McCarthy later recounted their experience in an interview. Quote, "The sight we saw I cannot drive away from my mind. It looked more like the work of a devil than of a man. I had heard a great deal about the Whitechapel murders, but I declared to God I had never expected to see such a sight as this. This whole scene is more than I can describe. I hope I may never see such a sight as this again," end quote. What McCarthy had seen was the mutilated body of Mary Kelly. Her skin had been cut away and placed on the bedside table, and her body, almost unrecognizable, lay in the bed. McCarthy sent Boyer to go get the police. When they arrived at the scene, the two officers were met with the same horrifying sight as McCarthy, a sight that would haunt them for the rest of their days. Arriving at the scene shortly after was police surgeon Dr. Thomas Bond. He recounted the appearance of her body in the post-mortem inspection. Quote, "The body was lying naked in the middle of the bed, the shoulders flat, but the axis of the body inclined to the left side of the bed. The head was turned to the left cheek, the left arm was close to the body with the forearm flexed at a right angle and lying across the abdomen. The right arm was slightly abducted from the body and rested on the mattress, the elbow bent and the forearm supine with the fingers clenched. The legs were wide apart, the left thigh at a right angle to the trunk, and the right forming an obtuse angle with the pubes. The whole of the surface of the abdomen and thighs was removed and the abdominal cavity emptied of its viscera. The breasts were cut off, the arms mutilated by several jagged wounds, and the face hacked beyond recognition of the features. The tissue of the neck was severed all round down to the bone. The viscera were found in various parts, viz. The uterus and kidneys, with one breast under the head, the other breast by the right foot, the liver between the feet, the intestines by the right side, and the spleen by the left side of the body. The flaps removed from the abdomen and thighs were on a table. The bed clothing at the right corner was saturated with blood, and on the floor beneath was a pool of blood covering about a 2 feet square. The face was gashed in all directions, the nose, cheeks, eyebrows, and ears being partly removed. The lips were blanched and cut by several incisions running obliquely down the chin. There were also numerous cuts extending irregularly across all features. The goriest murder marked the final murder, which concludes our episode today. Next episode, we will discuss theories, suspects, and the eerie similarities between the cases. Thank you for listening, and don't forget to lock your windows and doors.